even though they would have been only fighting in Northern Europe less than a year in comparison to the Soviets' 4 in the East, and would kill a small percentage of the German soldiers who fell to the Red Army. Moreover, the Allies would retake Northern Europe's wealthiest ground, the Soviets what had been its poorest, even before it was often plundered by the retreating German army. Stalin complained as well that the Allies' progress was only possible because of the Wehrmacht's decision to put up fiercer resistance to the East. In a way, that was true. As early as June 1944, the departing General Gerd von Rundstedt, who saw how the Western Front was draining German resources in the East, remarked to General Keitel at OKW of fighting in the West, "Make peace, you fools." After a brilliant landing at Normandy, the Allied advance from the beaches between June 6th and July 25th had become mostly static. Montgomery remained stalled outside Cayenne, tying down the bulk of German panzer forces, while the American First Army especially was bogged down in the thick hedges of the Normandy bocage. An anonymous U.S. infantry officer summed up hedgerow fighting. "In a war like this, everything was in such confusion that I never could see how either side ever got anywhere." The Allies may have known all of the minutiae surrounding the tides and sands of the Normandy beaches, yet they apparently had forgotten that just a few miles behind the beaches, most prominently Omaha, ran miles of hedgerows whose thickets, sunken woods, berms, and narrow roads were ideal for German defense. That was an odd lapse, given that at least a few of the American planners should have been familiar with the French countryside after their deployments in World War I, and somewhat knowledgeable of the peculiar landscapes near Omaha. The deadlock behind Omaha was partially ended by equipping American tanks with welded metal bumper teeth to break up the hedgerows. Soon armored rhinos were plowing through the berms, scooping up dirt to create passages cross-country, and thereby avoiding the deadly narrow roads. Americans had unwisely initially rejected the full array of British General Percy Hobart's funnies, ingenious adaptations of Churchill and, to a lesser extent, Sherman tanks, to meet German obstacles at D-Day. Apparently, ad hoc American ingenuity was less injurious to a sense of national pride than was adopting long-planned British modifications to Churchill's and their own Shermans. To break out of the difficult terrain and stubborn German resistance, the Americans eventually called on some 1,500 B-17 and B-24 heavy bombers to smash German fixed positions around Saint-Lô, on two occasions accidentally killing and wounding hundreds of American soldiers, among them Lieutenant General Leslie McNair. The air-assisted Operation Cobra, July 25th through the 31st, breakout opened up a wild month-long war of rapid advancement from August 1st to early September. Speed was now the objective to the Normandy campaign and would lead to vast encirclements of the German 7th Army at the so-called Falaise Pocket, where much of the German resistance in the West offered by the German Army Group B was trapped and ripped apart by American and British pincers until surviving remnants escaped across the Seine River. General George Patton's newly activated 3rd Army, for a brief period, advanced at rates of 50 miles per day, for a few days achieving a pace reminiscent of Sherman's March to the Sea. The volatile American press hyped the contrast between Patton's audacity and Monty's supposed timidity, enshrining such an armored dash as an American trademark that might end the war outright in 1944. As British and American momentum quickened, it became clear Scheif planners had never quite calibrated their planned tripartite eastward thrusts according to the nature of the respective generals who were commanding them and the strategic objectives for which they were intended. British and American differences soon crystallized over advancing on a broad versus narrow front. General Montgomery harped that his smaller forces should be given priority to thrust on a shorter choice route through Belgium and the Netherlands into the Ruhr, rather than having the Allies privilege the American Third Army's longer swing into Bavaria and Czechoslovakia that was to proceed simultaneously with a general advance all along the Allied line by General Courtney Hodges' First Army. Later German generals confessed that a concentrated thrust in late 1944 might have penetrated German defenses in a way that the broad approach never did before spring 1945. Still more paradoxes threatened Anglo-American unity in Normandy. General Montgomery was systematic and methodical and was caricatured, only occasionally unfairly, as a plotter. His trademark was the careful and long-planned advance. Monty was determined to take few risks in order to lower casualties, while avoiding German encirclement. He was an unlikely thruster for the shorter assigned route into the Ruhr, much less for a complex operation like the later Operation Market Garden attempt in September 1944 to take the various Dutch bridges near the mouth of the Rhine and hop into the Ruhr. Nor did it make much sense to stall Patton's ongoing blistering advance as he approached the Rhine in early September in order to focus supplies on Market Garden. True, Patton's route was circuitous and ultimately headed onward to Czechoslovakia, and his thrust had never really been part of the original Schaeff playbook. Yet by late August, his frantic advance had left Germans confused and scarcely able to regroup to offer serious resistance. The D-Day planners also never had fully anticipated the impossibility of ever wresting control of the Atlantic ports from the Germans. When the British and Americans finally entered key French port cities, they found many ruined. As a result, supply shortages stalled them as early as mid-September 1944, less than 3 months after the start of operations, and led to acrimony over competing claims for scarce fuel. The more the Allies landed more troops, and the longer they advanced from the coast, the more likely they ended up short of fuel, food, and parts, at least until the capture of the approaches to the key harbor at Antwerp. In short, the Western Allies' advance eastward into Germany after D-Day became erratic, characterized by 2 or 3 month cycles of both rapid advance and veritable immobility. Much of the slowdown was unavoidable, well beyond problems of supply. The coming of winter's shorter days and poorer weather would limit and hamper Allied air cover. Allied troops were more often camped outside in inclement autumn and winter weather, while retreating Germans were more often in familiar towns and cities. The Americans and British were short of ground combat troops, given the demands of their respective enormous air forces and navies, and of ongoing infantry campaigns in Italy, Burma, and the Pacific Islands. Intra-Allied rivalries began to affect joint operations, but above all, the Germans remained superb fighters who became even more formidable as they sought to bar entry into their homeland. With the close of the Normandy campaign in late August, perhaps a 500,000 German soldiers had been killed or captured, or were casualties. The vast majority of their armor and heavy weapons was lost. Yet the German army was scattered, not destroyed, and there were still over 1 million soldiers regrouping west of the Rhine to offer an autumn resistance. By mid-September 1944, the war in the West had stalled in yet a third cycle as rapid advances ceased, and the Allies once again returned to their slow progress of the previous June and early July. Bad weather and new Wehrmacht formations turned the Allies' mobile warfare into a depressing World War I scenario of fixed positions in the Hürtgen Forest, a small area near Aachen of densely wooded hills and ravines on the border between Belgium and Germany, as well as all across the larger Ardennes Forest and mountains to the southwest, slogs that would last for months, ensuring that the Red Army would be met in Germany, not in Eastern Europe, and that perhaps another 1 million Jews and Russian and Eastern European prisoners would die in the Nazi death and work camps. By World War I standards, the Wehrmacht might now have sought an armistice, but the necessary Allied demand for unconditional surrender of the criminal Third Reich, along with Hitler's directives, required the utter collapse of German resistance to end the war. Oddly, when the British and Americans had announced their demand for unconditional surrender at the Casablanca Conference in January 1943, the German General Staff had seemed indifferent to the assurance of an existential war to the end. General Varlimont remarked at the reaction at OKW to news of the Allied demand, "As far as I remember, I noticed hardly any notice was taken of it at German Supreme Headquarters." By February 1945, German reserves were once again, and for the final time, depleted after Hitler's foolhardy and failed Watch on the Rhine offensive in the Ardennes. Then a fourth and fluid stage of the Western theater saw the Allies in March cross the Rhine and race forward in all directions, often on the German autobahns. In early April, mobile Allied divisions sliced across the Third Reich, capturing hundreds of thousands of prisoners in vast encirclements and meeting the Russians at Elba. Especially later, at the height of the Cold War, debate would grow over General Eisenhower's decision as supreme commander of all British and American ground forces not to send his armies to take Berlin, but instead to abide by the letter of the preliminary agreements with the Soviets on spheres of influence in the post-war occupation of Germany, and to avoid assumed tens of thousands of needless British and American casualties by operating in the planned Russian zone. Yet it was never quite determined whether German armies would have offered the Western Allies less resistance, had they driven into Berlin, than the fierce defenses that met the Russians in Germany. It is easy to critique a series of Allied blunders that spiked infantry casualties and lengthened the war, some of them concerning the failure to exploit properly the talents of the unpredictable and occasionally obnoxious General Patton, the most talented of the senior Allied field generals. Generals Bradley and Montgomery were largely responsible for the delay in closing the Falaise Pocket, August 8th through the 21st, thereby allowing thousands of trapped Germans to escape, some of whom from the 2nd SS Panzer Corps were eventually refitted and made their way to the Netherlands and an unfortunate rendezvous in a few weeks with British and American paratroopers during the Market Garden debacle. Distracted by his Market Garden plans to leap over the Rhine River, General Montgomery in early September failed to secure the estuary approaches to the major Belgian port at Antwerp. The ensuing so-called Battle of Scheldt cost the British and Canadians over 12,000 casualties. The Allies would not have full use of Europe's largest port until the end of November, ensuring a continued supply shortage that would stall all Allied advances west of the Rhine. Another 65,000 soldiers of the German 15th Army also escaped Montgomery's assault on the estuaries around Antwerp and would join the Normandy remnants under Field Marshal Walter Model, who had assumed supreme command of German forces in the west, to stymie the British attempt less than a month later at the too-far Arnhem Bridge over the Rhine. In fact, Montgomery's Market Garden operation to leap the Rhine at the border of the Netherlands into Germany, September 17th through the 25th, 1944, proved an unfortunate waste of resources and ensured that the war would go on into 1945. It was flawed from the outset. Bad or warped intelligence, poor weather forecasting, and poor planning to send an armored column on a narrow, exposed road over at least six major enemy bridges, assumed to be secured in advance only by lightly armed airborne troops, many of whom had been dropped far too distant from their objectives. The resources allotted to the failed operation not only led to the delays in acquiring the free use of Antwerp, but also probably took away supplies from more mobile American armies and helped to stall the progress of the Third Army, another reason why the war would not end in 1944. Things became no better after the Allied disasters in the Netherlands and the Hürtgen Forest, September 19, 1944 through February 10, 1945. At the Battle of the Bulge, December 16, 1944 through January 25, 1945, the Americans, despite some warnings, were completely and needlessly surprised. The Germans focused nearly a quarter million of Hitler's last reserves in the West on the Green 99th and 106th Divisions and the veteran but exhausted 28th and blew them apart. More depressing still, the eventual American counterattack on the exposed German salient might have far better cut off its base rather than push it back mostly from the nose. The slow and methodical German retreat out of the Bulge would make it the single costliest American battle of the war, over 100,000 casualties. At a time when the German army was wrongly surmised to be fatally weakened and incapable of such damage. In war, the victor's penultimate casualties are always the most grievously felt, from the Union Army's 1864 summer catastrophes in Virginia, to the deadly German spring offensive of 1918, to the disaster on Okinawa, as if there could have been better ways to finish off a cornered and beaten enemy than to sacrifice infantry divisions in head-on confrontations. By the end of 1944, the Allies enjoyed ultra-intercepts, the British-supplied intelligence gathered by breaking German military codes, and virtual air superiority, had sizable intelligence units on the front lines, and were aided by thousands of resistance fighters in occupied Belgium and France. And yet they failed to anticipate right under their noses the largest single mustering of German troops in the West since the invasion of France in 1940. Among the other miscalculations that stalled the Anglo-American drive into Germany, The American First Army should never have entered the 50 square miles of the Hürtgen Forest, where for 5 months the confined, rough landscape stalled its motorized advance and cost 33,000 dead, wounded, and missing. General Hodges certainly should have been upbraided at best and at worst relieved for such an unnecessary theater, and he might have been had not the outbreak of the far larger Battle of the Bulge diverted attention from the ongoing nightmare. Once they entered the Hürtgen, the Americans gave up all their hard-won advantages. The forest made air support difficult, the trees and terrain nullified the edge of Allied air and mechanized mobility, as well as numerical superiority and superb artillery. Field Marshal Model may have been outnumbered 5-1, but he was a defensive artist known as an expert in stalling enemy advances, and he had found a perfect canvas for his greatest defensive masterpiece. Most of these difficulties could easily have been anticipated before the Americans were worn down in the longest continuous battle in U.S. history. When the Americans finally prevailed in the Hürtgen in February 1945, it was only because of the sheer preponderance of supply and numerical superiority. Better weather and German exhaustion facilitated the crossing of the Rhine in mid-March and empowered Allied armored thrusts into Germany. Despite the Allied blunders, the crossing of the Rhine just 9 months after the Normandy landing remained an astounding, if still controversial, achievement. For just a brief moment in late August 1944, it had seemed possible, with some imagination and improvisation, for the Third Army to have bounded over the Rhine into Germany despite its longer trajectory into Germany and the uncertainty of whether such a narrow salient would have trapped German forces on the Rhine or instead would have eventually been itself trapped on the German side of the river. Yet despite that disappointment, the veritable destruction of all German resistance in the West in just 11 months still exceeded most realistic pre-invasion predictions. In the American tradition of intense self-criticism, somehow doing better than expected did not excuse the missed opportunity of doing far better than expected. Historians cannot agree on the relative contributions of the respective Allied armies in defeating German ground forces. The huge Red Army, since June 21, 1941, had always faced far greater German resistance than had the British and Americans in terms of numbers of ground troops, aggregate tanks, and artillery. It may have killed 3 to 4 times as many German soldiers. But that said, the less experienced and far smaller armies of the British and Americans had managed to travel from the Normandy beaches to the German interior, 75% of the distance from Moscow to Berlin, in 11 months, not the 4 years that it took the Red Army to reach the German capital. And the Western Allies did so at 5% of the Soviet cost in infantry fatalities. Along their long advance, they had dispelled the specter of World War I that had haunted them with nightmares of another multi-year slog in France and Belgium against superior German infantry on the defensive and supplied by interior lines. World War II in the Anglo-American mind has now often crystallized into the iconic 11 months from D-Day to the motorized race through Germany in April and May 1945. Such chauvinism is often ridiculed, given that the terrible cost on the ground of destroying the German army in World War II was largely the story of Armageddon on the Eastern Front. True, but no other army on either side of the war, other than that of the British and Americans, had the ability to conduct such a huge amphibious landing and to supply and equip such a large army at such great distances from its embarkation. The primary achievement on the Western European battlefield of 1944 and 1945 was not the British and Americans' outright victory there or that they were responsible for the collapse of the German army, but rather that they were even able to land, fight, and prevail at all and at such relatively tolerable costs. A final expeditionary theater was the Allied effort in the Pacific and Asia, where American and British forces, as a requisite for either invading Japan or bombing it into submission, sent large expeditionary forces to cut off Japanese forces in order to liberate Allied territory and to gain air and naval bases to disrupt imports to the Japanese home islands. Fighting Japan was a war in and of itself, sometimes more analogous to the far earlier American campaign in the Philippines, 1899 to 1913, than to the contemporary conventional armored and mechanized collisions in North Africa, Western Europe, and the Soviet Union. In other words, there was a conventional ground campaign in the Pacific and Asia, but given the geography, the Japanese way of war, and the manner in which the combatants fought in the vast Pacific, it staggers the imagination to believe it was even part of the same war as the multiple infantry drives against the Third Reich. Other than some hard fighting in securing Malaya, February 1942, and the Philippines, April 1942, the Japanese Army pressed its offensive war against the Anglo-Americans after Pearl Harbor against little initial opposition. Indigenous troops often fled from the Japanese. There were few British or American ground forces outside the Philippines, Malaya, and Burma. By January 1942, Japanese expeditionary armies had successfully invaded Guam, Wake Island, the Dutch East Indies, New Guinea, the Solomon Islands, Kuala Lumpur, and Rabaul, while conducting major offensives in Burma and at times in China. In February, the Japanese conquered Bali and Timor as they neared Australia and bombed Darwin. Japanese forces cut the Burma Road in April and May 1942, isolating Chinese nationalists from easy resupply from British and American forces. The Japanese aim was to secure supplies of food, oil, and strategic minerals in crafting a new Pacific Empire, often by easily appropriating prior American, British, Dutch, and French infrastructure. Britain was to be severed from both India and Suez, and the Americans corralled east of Pearl Harbor, as a series of concentric rings of bases grew around Japan that both supplied and protected the homeland. In less than 2 years, and mostly in the first 6 months of the Pacific War, the Japanese had occupied the coast of mainland Asia from northern Manchuria to Indochina, and the Pacific from northern New Guinea to Wake Island and the Aleutians. It would take the British and Americans nearly 4 years to reclaim what Japan had grabbed in just a few months. Still, unquestioned Japanese military superiority did not last all that long. After the naval battles of the Coral Sea, May 1942, Midway, June 1942, and off Guadalcanal, August through November 1942, with new American carriers and fast battleships already under construction and most scheduled to arrive in 1943, the Japanese gradually lost the ability to land troops where they wished. Soon they could not easily supply their own recent occupations. Ideally, the quickest way for the British and Americans to end the Pacific War would have been to attack the Japanese mainland in 1942 and 1943 and destroy the 70 million person nerve center of the vast Japanese empire, leaving its 2 million man expeditionary force to wither in China and on the Pacific Islands. Yet that strategy, analogous to the fantasies of landing in France in 1942 or 1943, was impossible for three reasons. First, the British and Americans would not enjoy the air and naval superiority required to attack the Japanese mainland until early 1944. The vast Pacific was a far better defensive barrier than the Rhine or the Oder-Neisse line, a sometime eastern boundary of Germany. Second, the Allies probably would not have the requisite number of ground troops to invade Japan until the war was over in Europe. And third, the ability to bomb or blockade the industry of Japan required possession of bases within reasonable air range of the mainland and the production of far more bombers and training of more crews, as well as a sizable increase in Allied air, surface, and submarine fleets. Instead, the initial American strategy was to wage a series of naval battles and air campaigns to regain free transit on the Pacific. Then the United States would insidiously peel off layer after layer from the Japanese Empire to a point where new multi-engine bombers and naval air forces could mine the sea routes, support leapfrogging amphibious operations, and directly bomb the industrial centers of Japan. All the while, submarines and surface ships would chip away at merchant shipping and blockade Japan's recently acquired islands. Still, there were a number of intrinsic problems that would hamper these Allied strategic agendas. First, even before Pearl Harbor, British and American planners had loosely agreed on a Europe-first policy that governed the allotment of men and material. The survival of Britain was considered more pressing than that of China, and the liberation of France more important than that of the Philippines, which in strictly strategic terms was as much a burden as an asset in the pre-war wars. What Allied planners had not anticipated was that the enormous productivity of British and U.S. industry, as well as the huge scope of the American mobilization, meant that even in a secondary theater, Allied forces would become rapidly far better supplied than Japanese forces. While sharp disagreement initially arose between the irascible and brilliant Admiral Ernest King, Chief of U.S. Naval Operations and Commander-in-Chief of the United States Fleet, who hammered for more resources for the Pacific, and General Henry Hap Arnold, the commanding general of all U.S. Army air forces, who insisted on Mediterranean priority for aircraft allotments, by 1943 their divide would fade as Allied military production increasingly fueled two fronts. Second, Anglo-American cooperation characteristic of the European theater was looser in the Pacific, largely because of British colonial interests and the American sense of greater proximity to hostilities. The British Army and Royal Navy largely concerned themselves with protecting the Indian Ocean approaches to the Suez Canal, critical for the supply of British troops in Egypt before the destruction of the Italian fleet and German air power in 1943, and their surviving colonies in India and Malaya. Despite the veneer of Allied cooperation and infusions of large numbers of U.S. troops, especially air forces, into their theaters of command, British and Commonwealth sea, air, and land forces that would eventually reach 1 million men deployed to Burma under Supreme Allied Commander Admiral Lord Lewis Mountbatten and Ground Commander General William Slim would not be directly joined with the Americans on their island drive toward Japan itself until the final months of the war. Third, the Americans themselves were even further divided on how best to reach Japan. The disagreement sometimes pitted the Army against the Navy. The iconic General Douglas MacArthur, Supreme Commander of Allied Forces in the Southwest Pacific area, versus Admirals Ernest King and Chester Nimitz, Commander-in-Chief United States Pacific Fleet, and thus a dispute over following a more westerly approach through the Philippines or a northern route from Guadalcanal up through various archipelagos to Okinawa. At the root of the disagreement was whether the United States needed at all to retake the huge Philippine island group, fulfilling MacArthur's pledge that he would return to Manila to reach the Japanese mainland, or could instead bypass its 300,000-man Japanese garrison. In retrospect, the Philippines might well have been skipped, especially given the terrible losses to Americans and Filipino civilians incurred by storming Manila, and the lax measures to combat illness and disease, albeit while inflicting serious casualties on the Japanese. In sum, there was little strategic wisdom in dividing American forces into two rival advances. Finally, after late 1942, in hundreds of garrisons from New Guinea to Okinawa, the Japanese Army had months to prepare fortified bunkers and stockpile supplies. In light of the Japanese Army's warrior code that almost eliminated the option of surrender, U.S. ground forces would have to dig out and kill hundreds of thousands of Japanese defenders. A gruesome task that Tokyo believed might take years, would soon tire out the Americans, and might prompt eventual requests for an armistice. Dispersing Japanese soldiers all over the Pacific and Asia made their resupply almost impossible, but also often made American counter-strategy seem unfocused and incoherent. American soldiers, in most cases the U.S. Marines and over 20 Army divisions, were forced to fight a type of war unlike those on all other fronts, including perhaps even the savage Eastern Front, where millions of Germans and Russians were at least willing in extremis to surrender. The trick in American island hopping through the Pacific was in determining when and where to invade or not to, and to acknowledge that the more valuable targets were usually the best defended and their conquest might be the costliest. Sometimes, as in the case of parts of Borneo or the northern Philippines, enemy bases were taken that were better off bypassed, especially since by 1943 it was proving difficult for Japan to use any of its bypassed fortresses, such as those at Rabaul or Truk, to aid the motherland. One irony characterized all the island hopping from its beginning at Guadalcanal, August 1942 through February 1943, to its end at Okinawa, April through June 1945. The Americans radically improved their art of amphibious operation over its three-year lifespan, but so did the Japanese commensurably ratchet up their defensive and increasingly nihilistic capabilities. After the carnage at Tarawa, November 20th through the 23rd, 1943, 1,700 Americans killed, 2,000 wounded, the Americans refined their technique with closer air and naval support and wiser tactics on landing. Yet their final assault on Okinawa, combining the lessons of 17 months of further amphibious operations, proved the costliest, 12,000 dead, 38,000 wounded, of the entire Pacific War. If simply killing Americans had been the proper barometer of the Pacific War, then the Japanese seemed to have been improving faster than the Americans could defend themselves. After leaving Guadalcanal and the Solomon Islands, Admiral Nimitz's leapfrogging began from Tarawa, Macon, and Apamama in the Gilbert Islands in November 1943. Then the fleet and Marines and Army units headed northward to Kwajalein Atoll, Majuro, and Eniwetok of the Marshall Islands, January through February 1944. The key Marianas, taken in June through August 1944, were perhaps the most important of all the island acquisitions for future American airstrikes against the Japanese mainland, given their suitability as long-range B-29 bomber bases. The Americans headed north through the Bonin Islands at Iwo Jima, February through March 1945, and finished at Okinawa in the Ryukyu Islands, about 400 miles from the Japanese coast. Meanwhile, Douglas MacArthur's simultaneous Operation Cartwheel, after the Solomons campaign, headed eastward along the north coast of New Guinea, June 1943, through the neighboring Bismarck and Admiralty archipelagos, December 1943, detoured to Peleliu, September 1944, and then onward to the prize of the Philippines, October 1944. Such steady, incremental advances were critical to ensure U.S. lines of supply until air and naval bases could be established close enough to Japan to either bomb it into submission or conduct landings on the Japanese mainland. That said, just the two campaigns on the Philippines and Okinawa cost American and Allied air and land forces over 150,000 American casualties, but neither island group then factored into the air campaigns that eventually ended the war. The U.S. Marines alone had over 100,000 casualties spearheading island hopping. The Army lost around 200,000 killed, wounded, and missing. In addition, the Army Air Force suffered 24,000 total casualties in the Pacific in partnership with the Navy's own efforts to destroy the Imperial Japanese fleet while achieving campaign kill ratios ranging from 3-1 to 10-1 against Japanese island defenders. Both Army and Marine commanders under MacArthur and Nimitz soon discovered a disconnect about these operations. Unparalleled naval barrages and constant bombing softened up the islands, but did not always materially weaken the Japanese ability to resist attack, at least immediately. And precisely because the Marines and amphibious Army units proved such effective soldiers, and the U.S. Navy a superb supporting force, expectations for always quicker, less costly, and more frequent campaigns followed each impressive victory, especially in light of the fact that by mid-1943 there was little chance of ultimate Japanese success. The final outcome in the Pacific was largely foreordained by American manpower and material superiority. There was little chance that the United States would run out of either supplies or men, and none that it would lose heart and call off its amphibious campaign. Nor was there much mystery from late 1942 to summer 1945 over how many Japanese would die. The death toll could be accurately approximated by the total number of soldiers stationed on all those island garrisons that were not bypassed. The final paradox of the island-hopping strategy was that it alone provided the necessary air bases for atomic attacks on the Japanese mainland, which in turn precluded the climax of island-hopping itself, a frontal amphibious assault on the Japanese home islands. Two themes characterize the expeditionary campaigns of World War II that were waged simultaneously with the Soviet Axis bloodbath on the Eastern Front. The Western Allies, which were not contiguous by land to their enemies, had neither the immediate willingness nor the initial amphibious ability to invade the homelands of Germany and Japan, given the anticipated ferocity of respective Axis militaries fighting on home soil. Instead, the British and Americans first chose to weaken their opponents by landing troops in the Mediterranean, the Pacific, and Asia, on the periphery of the two major Axis powers, in order both to whittle down enemy manpower and cut off supplies to Germany and Japan. Despite serious losses and quagmires in Italy and the Philippines and on Okinawa, Allied Expeditionary Ground Forces won all their campaigns, largely because of superior naval and air forces. The Axis powers belatedly recognized that they had spread their own troops far too widely and thinly to fight a global war, especially against the world's two largest navies and strategic bomber fleets. A second fact aided the Allies. Their division of global responsibilities was not matched by the three Axis nations. Whereas the German army was bled white by the Red Army in Russia, and the Japanese were bogged down in China, neither the British nor the Americans, at least after mid-1940 and before mid-1944, were engaged in continental wars. As a result, during those 4 years, Britain and America were usually freer than Germany and Japan to bring more troops and supplies to a series of overseas fronts. Moreover, the Axis Expeditionary Ground Forces were almost always fighting on the defensive. The multidimensional skills acquired by mobile fighting in North Africa, Sicily, and Italy, especially the use of close ground support and naval supply, gave the Western Allies enormous advantages when they did meet the German army in France, specifically their increasing expertise at moving, protecting, and supplying armies. Moreover, once Axis air and naval support was neutralized abroad, German, Italian, and Japanese ground troops were usually trapped, either to be wiped out on islands like the Marianas and Iwo Jima, or forced to surrender en masse, as in Tunisia. In sum, the expeditionary wars ended in quite opposite fashion for the respective belligerents. The Western Allies won battles, gained experience, and honed their skills as they moved always closer to their enemies' homelands, without much interest in annexing and exploiting the lands that they fought on and conquered. In contrast, the Axis powers, which had sent their ground forces abroad early in the war, often with tenuous supplies and support, with the assumption that they would be fighting against weaker or inexperienced opponents, and with the idea of acquiring overseas territories, suffered disaster. Few of the many sent abroad came home. Apart from the great continental wars and the expeditionary campaigns, there was a third and most ancient sort of ground fighting in World War II. The besieging of cities and strongholds discussed in the next chapter. While many sieges were more iconic than transformational, a few were not, and they changed the course of the entire war. 14. Sieges. I lived for a time in the late 1970s on Mikras Asia Street in the Zografou section of Athens. The neighbors sometimes talked of Black Tuesday. They were referring to Tuesday, May 29, 1453, when Constantinople fell. I gathered from residents that it was likely that an angel had rescued the emperor, Constantine the 11th Dragases Palaiologos, minutes before he supposedly charged to his death against the Islamic hordes. Constantine had been delivered and turned to stone, or perhaps he was still suspended in marbleized animation. One day he would once again wake up, become flesh, and lead Orthodox Greek-speaking Christians on a crusade to take back their millennium-old capital of Hellenism from the Turks, with Constantinople the center of a Greek Aegean lake. Many elderly in the neighborhood had arrived in Zografou as refugees from Ionia after 1922, a half-century earlier, having fled a burning Smyrna ahead of a new Turkish army. They often went on to amplify Edward Gibbon's account of the fall of Constantinople, with folk tales of the desperate survivors waiting inside beneath the dome of the Cathedral of Holy Wisdom for the arrival of an archangel who would save them before the Ottoman Janissaries burst through the great doors. A half millennium had passed since the capture of Constantinople by the Ottomans, but my district of Athens and much of Greece of the 1970s still equated the siege of Byzantium with not just the collapse of Hellenism, the ancient idea of a Greek-speaking Mediterranean from Asia Minor to Egypt, but of civilization itself. Sieges against people resonate tragedy like no other manifestation of battle. The fall of Constantinople or the sieges of Vienna are more than battles. They become iconic of the fate of culture, history's flashpoints or perhaps metaphors of conflict itself. The sieges of World War II were not much different and took place in the Pacific, Asia, Russia, North Africa, and Europe. It is easy to calibrate in strategic terms and geographical diversity the importance of siegecraft in World War II. Hitler finally saw sieges as the only way of slowing down the Allied advances in 1944 and 1945, at various times declaring that Warsaw, Budapest, Kolberg, Königsberg, Küstrin, Danzig, and Breslau had become Festungen, fortresses, singular Festung, meant that the advancing Red Army might be bled white as it periodically bogged down in block-by-block fighting, a reverse Stalingrad many times over. By late 1944, Hitler the Nihilist cared little whether the resulting collateral damage inordinately killed Poles, Czechs, Hungarians, or even Germans. In like manner, Hitler's Atlantic port fortresses in the west, such as Brest, Calais, Dieppe, Dunkirk, Le Havre, and Saint-Malo, were never, in mid-1944, expected to see ships again, or indeed even to survive, but only to disrupt Allied advances. The civilian body count was often a savage reminder of the importance of siegecraft in the war. More than 1 million died at Leningrad amid mass starvation, epidemics, cannibalism, and daily barrages, a greater toll than any siege in history. There were over 200,000 Russians and Germans killed in the final siege of Berlin. More German women were likely raped there than during any siege of the past. The fighting inside a besieged Stalingrad proved to be the most costly single battle of World War II. At least 1.5 million Russians and Germans died over months of contesting the city's rubble, comparable only to the World War I German attack on the fortress complex at Verdun. Indeed, the deadliest front of the war, the Eastern, ultimately hinged on taking just three cities, Leningrad, Moscow, and Stalingrad. That the triad survived may have explained the larger failure of Operation Barbarossa. The European war itself ended when Berlin was successfully captured, or rather besieged, bombed, and shelled into ruin. We remember names of less existential encounters, like the otherwise obscure strongholds at Corregidor and Tobruk, largely because sieges are always the stuff of mass surrender or heroic resistance and can demoralize or inspire an entire people well beyond their strategic importance. The mass death at Leningrad, or the relentless destruction that rained down on Monte Cassino, January 17 through May 18, 1944, might be explained by the spiking anger of the besiegers over their inability to capture or even bypass their targets. Although World War II attackers did not, in 16th-century fashion, catapult the heads of prisoners inside the walls of Sevastopol, they could fire, as the Germans did at Sevastopol, a huge 31-inch railgun, Gustav, that blew apart far more flesh and bone with its 14,000-pound shells than any devilry that Demetrius I, the besieger, or Mehmed II, the conqueror, could conjure up. The horrors of Leningrad, from pestilence to cannibalism, were medieval. Of Hitler's Festung siege defenses, three were especially brutal. Budapest, December 29, 1944 through February 13, 1945, Breslau, February 15 through May 6, 1945, and Berlin, April 16 through May 2, 1945. In all three, the retreating German armies vainly sought to create their own Leningrad or Stalingrad that might exhaust the Red Army amid the rubble and lead to better terms of surrender. Or the besieged thought that the Red Army could be slowed down enough to allow other Germans, both civilians and military, to reach British and American lines. Furious German resistance was also predicated on nothing other than the fact that there were no other options, and surrender to the Soviet forces was felt to offer no better choice than fighting to the death. Somewhere around 1 million Soviet and Axis troops were killed, wounded, or missing in the fighting in and around Budapest, Breslau, and Berlin, with the Soviet victors losing more aggregate casualties, 600,000, than the besieged and defeated Germans, 500,000. German-occupied cities now fell in a way that Soviet ones earlier had not, largely because the Russian besiegers enjoyed not numerical parity, as had the Wehrmacht in 1941 and 1942, but rather overwhelming superiority at rates exceeding 5-1. The combination of siege and World War II immediately invokes two horrific names, Leningrad and Stalingrad. New force multipliers made the old agendas of previous invaders of Russia, whether the 1708 attack by Charles XII of Sweden or the grand failure of Napoleon in 1812, far more deadly for all involved. Totalitarian ideologies framed the struggle in Manichaean terms unlike anything seen in the rivalries of the past. Hitler planned a war of Nazi extermination to either kill off or enslave the supposedly inferior race of Slavic Untermenschen of Russia and liquidate millions of Jews in his eastward path. In turn, Russian resistance was couched in terms of communism's existential defense against fascism. Lives were not spared when it was a question of the very survival of the state apparat. Both civilians and prisoners were considered fair game. Both states mobilized a level of forces against the enemy and employed a degree of coercion against their own citizens on a scale unseen before. The Nazis intended to level their besieged targets, buildings, as well as people. The Soviets, in turn, preferred to see their own entrapped citizens perish if the Wehrmacht might be delayed or stymied, than declare a Leningrad or Stalingrad an open city, or systematically evacuate urban residents. Before he faltered, Hitler had promised to wipe Leningrad off the map and implied the same for Moscow. Moscow must disappear from the earth's surface. And Stalingrad. Stalingrad only survived in the sense that the Russians won the rubble that was left of the city. Berlin was captured and all but destroyed. Germans in Berlin saw their impending defeat as a mirror of what they had wished to do to Leningrad and expected commensurate vengeance from the Russians. A failed effort to storm a stronghold often left the exhausted and depleted attackers in almost as dire circumstances as those in a captured city. Army Group North never quite recovered its momentum once Leningrad did not fall. By late 1941, the would-be besiegers of Moscow were for a time in danger of becoming the besieged. In a matter of weeks, the German Sixth Army went from virtually conquering Stalingrad to being virtually destroyed by the very attempt. The capture of a stronghold or city was often iconic, quite aside from the cost to the doomed defenders. Britain suffered its two greatest psychological defeats in its long military history with the nearly inexplicable surrenders of Singapore and Tobruk, both the result of utter incompetence of the commanders in charge. Both Hitler and Churchill accepted that encircling cities could convey a sense of defeat in a way disproportionate to the city's actual strategic importance, and conversely, that withstanding the siege could encourage a sense of salvation. Of the dozens of great and minor sieges in World War II, however, only two might have changed the outcome of the war. Had Leningrad quickly fallen by August 1941, or had Stalingrad, on the arrival of the German Sixth Army, promptly succumbed a year later, the Russian front would have looked quite different by late 1942. Otherwise, even the dramatic fall of a Tobruk did not necessarily alter the ultimate course of the war. The capture of a Berlin or Breslau in 1945 was never really in doubt. Even the defeats at Singapore and Corregidor, as psychologically damaging as they were to the British and the Americans, did not much change the eventual outcome in the Pacific. That many German-controlled Atlantic ports survived until the war's end, or that Sevastopol fell in 1942, ultimately did not alter the verdict of either the Western or the Eastern theater. In the past, the collapse of entire civilizations, Carthaginian, 146 BC, Jewish, AD 70, the Abbasid Caliphate, 1258, Byzantine, 1453, Al-Andalus, 1492, and Aztec, 1521, often followed the capitulation of their capital or largest cities. It is understandable that even in the 20th century, the fate of a Leningrad, London, Malta, Moscow, or Stalingrad marked at least a temporary shift in the direction of the war. In most theaters of World War II, armies headed for capitals. The Nazis thought the fall of Paris doomed France, just as the Allies did when they later bartered over who would storm Berlin. Operation Barbarossa aimed at taking Leningrad, Moscow, and Kiev. The majority of the major sieges of World War II proved successful. Berlin, Breslau, Budapest, Corregidor, Sevastopol, Singapore, and Tobruk. Yet the most decisive and lethal sieges, either by land or air, at Leningrad, Stalingrad, and Malta, replete with constant bombing, all failed. As a general rule, Axis sieges, for example Singapore, Corregidor, or Tobruk, were effective before mid-1942 when Germany, Italy, and Japan had air or naval superiority, or at least rough military parity with their enemies. After that turning point, the Axis usually failed, and the Allies took most of the strongholds they targeted, or themselves survived when besieged, given the growing reversal in relative logistics and air power. In all the changing landscapes of war, from submarines beneath the sea to bombers above 20,000 feet, successful operations hinged on advantages in supply, logistics, aggregate experience, manpower, technology, morale, and generalship. At exception were the final redoubts of the Japanese and Germans when faced with overwhelming odds. The Allies assumed that their Axis enemies ensconced by 1944 in Singapore, Corregidor, and the Atlantic fortified ports would not surrender as they themselves had earlier when surrounded in these exact same fortresses. As a result, they often decided that they would not suffer much strategic disadvantage by simply delaying assaults until later in the war, for example, Corregidor, or bypassing such fortresses, Singapore, many of which surrendered only at the end of the conflict. While the widespread use of rebar and other forms of reinforced concrete helped the besieged, defenders also had recourse to their own artillery and air assets to neutralize air attack, flak, anti-aircraft guns, and fighter planes. Besieged populations could sometimes be resupplied by air or sea, or at least by ground or naval forces protected by air cover. As was frequent in the long history of siegecraft, better defense prompted an improved offensive response. There were plenty of sieges in World War I, but none where air power proved significant. Yet just two decades later, for the first time in history, fixed citadels and cities were subject not just to distant artillery, but also to regular and heavy aerial bombing. The Soviets, for example, would fire over 1 million shells into Berlin, but mostly after the city had almost been reduced to rubble by Allied bombers. Even if aircraft could not obliterate a city without sustained air superiority, planes could at least provide cover for the attacks of the besiegers and prevent relief columns from reaching the trapped garrison. Indeed, one reason why there were not even more sieges in World War II's vast intercontinental arena of conflict was the preference for aerial destruction, a nihilistic siege by bombers without the costly use of ground troops. Hitler, who never invested in heavy bombers, talked of razing entire cities of the Soviet Union, but lacked the resources to wipe away Leningrad and Moscow in the manner that the Allies bombed the urban cores of Hamburg, Dresden, and Tokyo into rubble. There were numerous destructive sieges of this sort conducted against Cologne, Dresden, Hamburg, London, and most of the major Japanese cities, with a motive of destroying or terrorizing rather than capturing the urban core. Yet even among the debris of a bombed-out city, what little was left was not captured until infantry caught up with the planes and physically occupied the rubble. The armies of World War II sometimes besieged the same cities that, given the timeless reference of history and geography, had always been strategic linchpins in past wars. Replace the Ottoman Janissaries with the Luftwaffe and the Regia Aeronautica, and some four centuries later the walls of Malta once more were battered by the invader. Hitler may have been encouraged and at times confused by the successful Napoleonic assault on Moscow, and perhaps by the earlier conflagration set by the Crimean Tartars in 1571 that engulfed the city. Sevastopol had never been bombed before the arrival of the Germans, but it had been besieged, shelled, and captured by Western Europeans in 1855. The German encirclement of Leningrad was the longest and most lethal siege in history at 872 days. When it began on September 8, 1941, Leningrad was the largest city at 2.5 million inhabitants ever to endure complete envelopment. Yet amid Nazi bombing, artillery strikes, starvation, disease, the cold, and the desperate effort to evacuate the blockaded city, Leningrad nevertheless was among the first major sieges of the 20th century to fail. Nearly 4 million Russian soldiers were killed, wounded, went missing, or were captured in the fighting in and around Leningrad and on the nearby Baltic front during the siege. Indeed, the Red Army suffered 14% of all its World War II casualties defending the single city and key port on the Gulf of Finland. Russian dead in and around Leningrad were four times greater than the death toll of all Americans lost in World War II. Leningrad, known as St. Petersburg before 1914 and then Petrograd between 1914 and 1924, also may have been the first major attempt of attackers since the final days of Tenochtitlan, 1521, to extinguish rather than to seize a city, although Hernán Cortés, unlike Hitler, originally had not planned to kill its inhabitants altogether. The Führer has decided to erase the city of Petersburg from the face of the earth, read a Nazi directive. We propose to closely blockade the city and erase it from the earth by means of artillery fire of all caliber and continuous bombardment from the air. Even the Romans who had leveled Carthage and the Ottomans who sacked Constantinople did not envision killing all the besieged as Hitler planned at Leningrad. I have no interest in the further existence of this large population point after the defeat of Soviet Russia. In the end, the opposite occurred, and Leningrad ground down Hitler's Army Group North into a shell of its former self, even as Pearl Harbor, the Japanese ascendancy in the Pacific, the Stalingrad nightmare, Kursk, and the Italian campaign all took world attention away from besiegers and the trapped citizenry at Leningrad, who settled down to dying in the thousands per day and in obscurity. Three German army groups were poised for the attack on the Soviet Union on June 22, 1941. Army Group North, the 16th and 18th Armies, and the 4th Panzer Army, led by the purportedly anti-Nazi Field Marshal Wilhelm Ritter von Lieb, was the smallest. Yet it perhaps had the best chance of obtaining its objectives. Some 29 divisions of about 655,000 infantry and air personnel stormed through the Baltic states and the northwestern border of the Soviet Union. Simultaneously, the Finns, the most capable of the Germans' European allies, approached southward toward Leningrad with perhaps a 250,000 of their own troops. The latter had fought the Russians to a standstill in 1939, and yet in the continuation of that war in 1941 were never given adequate military equipment by the Germans. Colonel General F.I. Kuznetsov's Baltic Special Military District, whose charge was the defense of Leningrad, was inadequately equipped and poorly led. Initially, Kuznetsov, soon to be relieved in August, commanded less than half the invaders' number, or about 370,000 total troops. The Russians, however, enjoy the advantage of fighting on familiar ground. For a while, they drew on the vast manpower and munitions industries of Leningrad itself. The defenders began the battle with an impressive number of tanks, artillery pieces, and planes. That said, General von Lieb, in the days preceding his arrival before the city, assumed that the Luftwaffe would have at least softened up Leningrad. That may have been an odd conjecture, given that Luftwaffe bombers, despite enjoying air superiority, had never really broken the will of any Russian city. For example, German air forces would conduct 90 major raids on Moscow and drop over 50,000 incendiaries in achieving almost no strategic results. The 500-mile route of advance of Army Group North, from staging areas around Königsberg in East Prussia to the suburbs of Leningrad, was somewhat shorter than the Wehrmacht's central axis to Moscow, or the southern path to Kiev and on to the distant Caucasus. The pathway was well known to Germans who had reached within 100 miles of Petrograd, St. Petersburg, in March 1918. Unlike Hitler's other two army groups, Central and South, Group North's divisions passed much of their way on sympathetic ground. The people of the recently Russian-occupied Baltic states saw von Lieb's troops as liberators. Lithuanians, Latvians, and Estonians anticipated the German arrival by staging insurrections against Soviet occupiers, as if new foreign authoritarians might be better than old totalitarians. The Finnish National Army had proved itself against the Russians and was the most knowledgeable of Hitler's allies of the Soviet way of war. And yet, also abided by the Finnish unwritten understanding with Stalin that after 1940, neither the Finns nor the Russians would enter into the heartland of each other. Finnish General Carl Gustav Emil Mannerheim's 16 divisions were to approach Leningrad from the north to occupy the shore of Lake Ladoga, the immense body of fresh water on the city's northeastern border and the largest lake in Europe, and to stop both escape from and supply to the city. In a historic decision, the Finns would not directly besiege Leningrad, but rather sought to reclaim only surrounding territory lost to the Russians in the 1939 border war. Leningrad was a major port. The Russian Baltic fleet would be routed and destroyed, and thus the city's imported supplies cut off. Army Group North, in turn, could and would in part be supplied through the Gulf of Finland by maritime transport far more easily than could the other German army groups to the south by rail or road. The greatest naval defeat of the European theater was the panicked Soviet naval evacuation from nearby Tallinn, Estonia, between August 27th and 30th, 1941. German and, to a lesser extent, Finnish bombing, coastal artillery barrages, surface attacks, and mines killed over 12,000 Russian seamen and evacuees. The Germans and Finns sank 16 warships and about 60 transport vessels and completely shut off Leningrad's access to the sea. The two main ports on the Gulf of Finland, Helsinki and Tallinn, remained Axis-held for nearly the entire siege of Leningrad. Lake Ladoga became Leningrad's only remaining lifeline by autumn 1941. But just as Hernan Cortes finally turned Lake Tenochtitlan against the besieged Aztec capital, so too the Germans believed that they could use Lake Ladoga as a barrier and so make their blockade that much tighter. Such thinking, however, was predicated on taking the city before the lake froze over. When that did not happen, the lake became a land bridge from Russian lines to the city limits. Von Lieb's original plan had assumed that Group North would race through Estonia and hit nearby Leningrad on the run. The armored assault led by the 4th Panzer Army would surprise the city in the way Warsaw, Copenhagen, Amsterdam, Brussels, Paris, Belgrade, and Athens had all been shocked into capitulation. In Hitler's mind, German control of the shores of the Baltic ensured iron ore imports from Sweden, which were essential to German industry. Army Group North and the Finns on their own ground would need only to station residual forces to oversee the quick starvation of Leningrad's population, as shelling and bombing reduced the city to rubble. Hitler's initial directives to Army Group North were clear that Leningrad had to be captured. The Baltic coast had to be secured. Soviet naval power had to be destroyed, and Kronstadt had to be leveled, all before the final assault on Moscow. As Operation Barbarossa began, Army Group North moved at the rate of more than 20 miles a day through the Soviet-occupied Baltic states, covering the first 280 miles in just 2 weeks. Von Lieb finally slowed in mid-July. Yet German progress never ceased entirely. By early August, the Germans were only 60 or so miles from Leningrad. Despite worn-out equipment, exhausted and dead horses, mounting losses, and unexpectedly stiff Soviet defenses, at the beginning of September, some panzers were camped just 30 miles outside of Leningrad, days away from taking the city. In adopting a strategy of active defense, Mannerheim's Finnish forces then dug in, waiting to hook up with Army Group North on the shores of Lake Ladoga, about 20 miles north of the city. By mid-September, only 7 miles separated the German front to the south from the city limits. Given the unexpectedly ferocious resistance, a baffled Hitler now began to have second thoughts and ordered Army Group North to adopt static siege positions around Leningrad. Perhaps the daily bombing, shelling, and starvation would destroy Leningrad without a frontal assault and save German troops for the impending attack on Moscow. Hitler's armies were so far unbeaten. He had no intention of sending them into street-by-street fighting, given that almost every other targeted enemy city had surrendered or capitulated almost as soon as the panzers appeared at the city limits. At Leningrad, Hitler would avoid inducing the quagmire that he would endure a year later at Stalingrad. Nazi logisticians figured that they might still be on the way to Moscow by mid-October, as if their worn-out forces could mount another major offensive as autumn wore on. But along with his later diversions of elements of Army Group Center to the Kiev front, the sudden cancellation of a direct assault on Leningrad would become one of Hitler's additional miscalculations. Bombing and shelling civilians, as well as ensuring starvation and disease, was not the same thing as entering and occupying a city. The ensuing siege of Leningrad would soon turn pre-modern. By February 1942, on some days, 10,000 city residents perished from exposure, starvation, and infection. Sporadic cannibalism broke out. Plagues spread. Corpses remained unburied. In a diary entry dated December 23, 1941, Valery Sukhov lamented, "Papa barely walks, Mama staggers. We're hoping for January. In the evening, I sat down to draw. I forgot about everything. A week ago, I began to study German. We cooked soup from carpenter's glue and ate all of the starch. Papa is prepared to eat the corpses of those killed in the bombardment. Mama refuses." Power, water, and sewage services failed. Due to prior evacuation, military enlistments, and death, The city shrank to a fourth of its pre-war population. Hitler congratulated himself on not wasting German soldiers in running street battles. The truth was that he was squandering forces that were never designed for static siege operations and running out of time as the cold weather worsened. In November 1941, both the 4th Panzer and recently added 3rd Panzer armies were pulled out and sent southeastward for the planned final assault on Moscow. That transfer was confirmation that Operation Barbarossa had essentially failed. According to the plans of the frustrated German high command, the fate of Leningrad would now have to wait until 1942, although it was still confident of the final outcome. Early next year, we enter the city. If the Finns do it first, we do not object. Lead those still alive into inner Russia or into captivity. Wipe Leningrad from the face of the earth through demolitions, and hand the area north of the Neva to the Finns. Hitler, for all his fantasy talk about a superior race of Übermenschen, miracle weapons, and the role of willpower, ironically had no idea of the mettle of the Russian people, who had suffered enormously before the war from Stalin's purges, state-induced famines, and brutal industrialization, and could withstand hardship in a way that perhaps only the Japanese could match. Nor did he appreciate the talent of the residents of Leningrad itself, which in terms of civic achievement, scientific excellence, university life, and cosmopolitan culture was the equal of any European city. While the conditions inside Leningrad were horrific, the besiegers also, by November 1941, were suffering terribly from the fierce cold and lack of shelter. The swamps, marshes, lakes, and rivers around Leningrad in summertime had seemed to aid the Germans' lines of circumvallation. But by winter, they froze and offered porous holes in the besiegers' defenses, especially when bad weather often grounded the Luftwaffe. Skilled Soviet engineers were able to craft an ice road, the road of life, across Lake Ladoga, sending in tons of supplies from eastern Russia during the winter months and bringing out over 1 million half-starved city residents. Finally, Hitler never developed any comprehensive strategy about whether it was wiser to storm, blockade, or bypass Soviet centers of resistance. Because Germans started and then interrupted sieges in ad hoc fashion, transferring armies northward and southward while firing generals, Leningrad, Moscow, and Stalingrad all survived. Resistance at Leningrad doomed over 1 million Russians, but Stalin accepted that human catastrophe as part of the cost of saving the greater Soviet state, itself nearly fatally exposed to German aggression as a result of Stalin's own non-aggression pact with Hitler. Had Stalin declared Leningrad an open city, as the Allies had Athens, Brussels, and Paris, he would have abetted the German drive on Moscow, and Leningrad's citizens likely would have been slaughtered with little chance of fraternization with the occupiers. As long as Leningrad was besieged, a fourth of German forces were for all practical purposes tied down far from the pivotal fronts around Moscow, and later in the Crimea and at Stalingrad, where the war would be won or lost. The suffering and survival of Leningrad, a city famous for both its St. Petersburg Tsarist heritage and its later eponymous communist vanguard status, served as a powerful global symbol of resistance to fascism. In the immediate aftermath of the war, rumors mounted that Stalin had diabolically seen some strategic advantage in not making sacrifices to save or completely evacuate the city. As a result, the architects of Leningrad's miraculous survival grew in stature even within the Communist Party. Stalin struck back. Many of those whose brilliance had saved Leningrad from Hitler were either executed or exiled in the so-called Leningrad Affair, a bitter footnote to the resistance. The Germans, for their part, never disengaged from the Baltic front. After the siege began, German forces, despite haphazard reinforcements, insidiously shrank. The Red Army always grew. Army Group North had occupied the least amount of Mother Russia's territory of all Hitler's pincer groups. It eventually was to be besieged itself by an enemy that became better equipped and better led, even as it endured far more dead and wounded. For the Russians, Leningrad was both a victory and a holocaust. For the Germans, it was another fork on the highway to oblivion. The name Stalingrad still invokes horror. Yet when Operation Barbarossa began in June 1941, few in the German army had ever heard of the city. Certainly it was not a major strategic objective, as were Kiev, Leningrad, and Moscow. Today, Stalingrad is renamed Volgograd, Volga City, a provincial city of about 1 million people, largely unknown outside of Russia. The attack on Stalingrad, also formerly known as Tsaritsyn, was never a conventional siege, or rather, it soon became two sieges. The first was the German near encirclement of the Russian city between August 19th and November 22nd, 1942, by a huge army from the northern wing of Army Group South, led by General and eventually Field Marshal Friedrich Paulus. In early August, his army, with surprising speed and economy, reached the key Volga River as part of a larger plan to capture or destroy, or both, the riverside industrial city of Stalingrad. That way, Paulus, as part of the more northern wing of Army Group B, could next pivot southward along the banks of the Volga, clean up pockets of resistance, and protect the flank of Army Group A of Army Group South. Under the general outlines of Hitler's Case Blue plan, laid out in a Führer directive of April 1942, the two recombined armies, after cutting off the Volga River, would then advance in tandem to expropriate Soviet oil supplies from the Caucasus and Caspian Sea fields. Supposedly, the Russians, bewildered that the main German thrust of 1942 had not focused on their sizable but stalled armies around Leningrad and Moscow, would lose the major source of their fuel. Yet the Germans persisted in the same flawed assumption that large Russian cities could be rapidly stormed or forced to surrender, releasing the besiegers to move on to